Eguye lande con inia inia. Oh, 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 eh, 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 eh. Oh, lonnie, we get on ya, in ya. Oh, God, run, go, not dish. Oh, God, run, go, not dish.
Hello there! Welcome to the Wish Day Podcast, and in this episode, I talk to Brian Young, a Navajo author whose book, The Healer of the Water Monster, was released this year in May. We talk about how we knew each other prior to its publication, and Brian tells us about the obstacles he faced trying to get this book published, as well as the tropes that tend to still exist within the writing institutions, as well as publications. Halfway through it, we talk about the actual book, certain themes, characters, and story plot lines worth fleshing out. Some things that I thought were pretty interesting were Brian's practices in responsibly and ethically writing and incorporating Navajo ideas, philosophy, and stories within his book, considering the history of non-natives writing about natives. Please support Brian. If you want to check out the book, I will keep a link in the description. I implore everybody to check out the book, read it themselves, or pass it to someone they might be interested in, or buy the book and donate it to a library, particularly within the Navajo Nation. I want to say thank you to Brian for his time. I want to say thank you for listening. This is the Wish Day Podcast.
All right, Yate, she'e Brian Young in Asia, Kachi in Ashligo, Tatnasatne Bashichin, Torichi in Dashache, Ako, Torikosha e Dashinelle. Hastin, Apotego Hastin Nishle, Seto Adet Nashakongi, DJ A, Brooklyn Dishland. Hey everyone, my name is Brian Young. I am author of Healer of the Water Monster, and I am originally from the Fort Defiant Sawmill area, but currently live in Brooklyn, New York. And I can't have Marley for having me on your wonderful podcast. It's an honor.
No, definitely. I mean, I am very great. Like, I'm very appreciative of you being on here because one, you just wrote a book that I really like. And I was telling my partner that it's something, a book I'd want to read to my son. But it also happens that we have history as well. We briefly worked in the same at Diné Policy Institute. And you were teaching me and a bunch of other coworkers how to like get in shape, or not get in shape, but like to be healthy and more active. Yeah. So when you wrote this book, I was like, wow, I only see this as that dude who made me get on that half, that inflated ball. Yeah. And then you were like, now do squats and hold something. And then I was like, oh shit. Cause I remember that. And my legs were so like jelly after that because.
Oh yeah. They're like shaking and everything.
Yeah, exactly. Like they were like, cause for the people listening, it's like this, what did you call it again?
It's called a Bosu. There's like a flat portion, like a black portion, and then there's an inflatable half. So it's kind of like half of a globe. And it's used for a lot of like stability exercises. It can be a lot of abdominal work as well. But I love it for its balance.
My balance was on point after that summer. And like you made me like do squats on it. And then I was like, oh, this is easy. But then as I stepped on it, I was like shaking. And I was like, oh, no, this isn't good. And then you're like, you need to go lower, bro. And I was like, I don't think I can go lower. My legs are getting shaky. And you're like, you gotta do it. Get lower. And I was like, yeah. So when you wrote this book, all that I was associated with you is like our work together. Knowing you from that brief moment, like that summer, and then reading this book, I was like, damn, why didn't I ever just ask him? Like, I knew you were going for like a.
Yeah, I think you guys asked me at various point in times like what I was doing, because at that stage of my writing career, I was just about to go into Columbia's writing program. Moroni Benali had like contracted me to work with a group of you guys at Diné College to analyze the effects of exercising in a work environment. It was a fun time for me. But yeah, I was just about to go into my creative writing program, and completely rewrite the entire thing from start to finish.
Were you writing this book, this new book, around that time, or was it afterwards a little bit?
So Healer of the Water Monster, I've been working on for about 7 or 8 years. And when I met you guys, I was still kind of working on it, but taking some time off from it to give me space to be able to look at it critically and narratively. I really needed to grow as a writer and a storyteller at that time.
Okay, I read the afterword and you were talking about how it came to you. It was like this idea that you had while you were, I think, washing dishes, was it? I don't remember what it was. It was like some job. Yeah, cutting meat.
Cutting meat.
And I was really like that because I too like that. I daydream a lot. Can you give us like a brief synopsis of the story?
Sure, of course. Off the back of my head. So Healer of the Water Monster is about a young Navajo boy whose name is Nathan, 11 years old, decides to spend his summer with his paternal grandmother, Nali, at her mobile home site just north of Church Rock, New Mexico, to do a science experiment examining the water consumption of heirloom kernels that his Nali has received from her family line versus store-bought kernels. And Nali lives traditionally how I kind of grew up, without running water, electricity, just very, very far away from infrastructure and isolated. And the area that she currently lives in has been in a drought for about 30 years. And because of that, they have to haul water and be very conscious of their water consumption. So one night, Nathan is following something that has been stealing his seeds and interrupting his experiments. And he comes across a water monster from Hajime Bahanet, which is Navajo emergence story or our creation mythology. And in my fiction, I say that water monsters control rain with songs and they protect bodies of water such as lakes, rivers, and ponds. And this particular water monster has been sick for about 30 years. And because of the sickness, he hasn't been able to sing down the rains, thereby causing the drought. So Nathan strikes up a deal, and to get out of the desert, he will help heal the water monster.
I particularly like the fact that you, in this story, were able to bring to life. I don't even know, because when I say bring to life, it sounds like I'm implying that what you're writing about was dead to begin with. We're always like relegated to the past. And I think with this story, you do a really great job of bringing together the contemporary times with like our origin stories and really showing that they're informative. And I was wondering, when you're writing about this, the first question being, was it hard to like to write as about Indigenous people in the present? Because there's so much literature that like makes us sound like we're like prehistoric, we're like pre-modern, you know, like we're still like just not in modernity.
Hell no, it was super easy. At least the writing portion of it. I mean, we are Navajo and we are in modern times, and that's not a very hard thing to do most of the time. There are some challenges, but for most of, like I would say 85 to 90% of our time, it's easy living in the modern era. So actually writing a story that does center around our traditional beliefs, our views of where we come from, like that was a no-brainer, because I was taught that was how we grew, that was how we evolved, and that is where we came from. And also my grandma and grandpa, who were my main sources of inspiration for the story and my main introduction to these stories when I was a very young kid, would always kind of insinuate that those creation stories never ended, that creation era continued into modern times. So it was always, I say this a lot, but it was always kind of like when we were driving past like a mound or a mountain that's in Nlede is Cholinewolie, that's where, or that mountain over there, Gubernator Knob, that's where the holy beings found Changing Woman as an infant. So there was always a real tangibility to those stories to me, and they'd always say, or listen or watch, and you'll see the holy beings if you pay attention. So that kind of belief system and that kind of awareness of not only the stories, but also the land was very easy to translate into a book, because that's how I grew up But what was difficult about the process was when I was pitching it to agents, when I was in the middle of my writing program. That was where I found a lot of the prejudices of natives being stuck in the past. But when it came to the actual writing process, it was like, all I could see was the space where my story could inhabit. And there was a wide open space where only my story and very few others existed. So there's a lot of opportunity in that space to put natives, for natives, put stories that have natives in the modern context for younger readers.
You bring out a lot of things that I really resonate with. So I'll briefly go over this idea that the creation story is still ongoing is perfect, because to me, that's like a way of countering this history of us being relegated to the past, but also looking at like this ongoing, I'll say struggle because I think in terms of politics, but like this ongoing struggle, but also persistence to maintain our presence within this current political project. When I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about how a lot of our political projects and struggles are actually tied to the land, which goes back to what you were saying, is it's almost inseparable. And in this case, like your story is like the crux of it. Like it talks about a certain being, a deity. As you're going through the narrative, you realize that water and land are almost inseparable. And I think that's something I'm becoming more aware of, you know, living in Shiprock and, you know, trying to grow some tomatoes. Like you need both. But yeah, no, I was wondering if you'd feel comfortable maybe mentioning some of the tropes that you encountered when you're trying to pitch these ideas. I imagine natives still feel like we still encounter these, I think the term might be microaggressions, of how when we talk about ourselves, that people who aren't educated still perpetuate these. And I was wondering maybe if you were comfortable talking about some of the things you encountered when trying to pitch these ideas that you felt were issues.
Sure, of course. I think the biggest thing that became exhausting over time was the constant need to explain Hajine Bahanet to non-Navajo agents, to non-Navajo individuals who weren't familiar with that story, with that history. So just like I pitched the story to you, I would have to go into this whole kind of tangent of explaining what the story was, and you know, the four worlds, and it kind of expanded what would otherwise be a 5-minute pitch into like a 12-minute one. So after a while, it just became second nature to also include the traditional stories, Hajine Bahanet, up to the point of where I needed to get them accustomed to what I was pitching. But when I pitched it to my best friend, who sadly passed away, he's like, "Brian, why are you telling this? I already know the creation story." And it hit me. It just hit me like right off the head. Like, oh my God, this is what it's like to be a minority in the publishing industry, because I have to put in that extra effort all the damn time when I'm pitching this, my story, my book, to non-Navajos, to put myself in that situation, and then to their lack of learning, lack of knowledge. But more kind of overt forms of microaggressions, and for those of you who don't know what microaggressions are, they're like these little annoyances that you encounter every single day. And the way I explain them is like a flick. And you know, any given day, like you can just brush it off. It's no big deal. Like you have the patience, you have the tools set to just kind of like go about your day having experienced that microaggression. But living out in the East Coast off of, you know, Nepakea, off of Navajo homelands, being the only Navajo in an environment, in a diverse environment, it becomes exhausting, because that single question of why do you have short hair? Why don't you have braids? You are asked that like at least 50 times a day for over a month. And that becomes compound. And that becomes really annoying, really frustrating, really exhausting to have to deal with. And so like, say for instance, you have a bad day and then someone asks you, "Hey Brian, why don't you have your long hair and braids?" You get pissed off, and you, those tool sets that you have just don't cut it. And it it's not my space. It's not my responsibility to explain why I have short hair. And in that line of thinking, a lot of the kind of microaggressions I encountered were Nathan's appearance. Like the most fresh one that I can remember, the biggest one I can remember when I was pitching to an agent was like, an agent said this to me, I think you should have Nathan with long hair and a scene where Nelly is braiding a feather into his braids. So that way the readers will know that he's Indian.
Jesus.
And I was like, bye, Felicia. I ain't going to deal with you anymore. I'm not going to have to deal with this.
That's the only appropriate response to that. Like that, at that point, yeah, exactly. At that point, it's no longer like a flick. It's like a slap in the face.
Yeah.
I think like I'm surprised because I suspected that as most Native people go throughout the world, there's a sense of this logic of authenticity that if you don't look like the authentic Native that's static in its appearance and practices, even the way you talk, you are automatically questioned. Your authority to speak on certain things is like questioned. And I kind of experienced a little bit of it. Not necessarily authenticity, but a different type of microaggression that has to do more with erasure. When I was in the Southeast, my partner and I would be walking around the neighborhood and some person was like, just started speaking Spanish to us. And we were like, what?
Happens all the time.
Yeah, I know. Right. And then I'm just like, oh, we don't speak Spanish. And they're like, oh, are you not from Mexico? And I'm like, no, like what? And then I guess like there's a lot of migration. So like to hear your experience in the publishing world, having to deal with authenticity, or the politics of authenticity, like it speaks to what I think your book does a really good job of showing that there is no quote unquote authentic Native, but like, and I think the idea of an authentic Native is one that's premised on this idea of Native people not being modern. Your book shows it's like, no, this is not the case. Like we're consistently evolving. We draw upon different things. So I do like that. And I do think that there's something about this experience that you have when you speak to Native. You don't need to like devolve everything. You know, you don't need to like talk about something sacred. They know there's a boundary that like they cannot cross. Like, and it goes, I think to me, it reminds me of like Audra Simpson's idea of like refusal. Don't necessarily have to talk about everything. This idea of refusal is a political gesture. It's also, I guess, more of a political act.
I actually encountered that in my writing group. And I that's one of the benefits of the writing program that I went through was that a lot of my readership were non-Navajo, were, you know, wealthy white people, for lack of a better word. So I was able to kind of toy with how much I could share without indicating that there are restrictions. And when I discovered, when I did have in the story that there were restrictions that I had to abide by, like pretty early in the book, that's when I encountered a lot of, I don't want to say hesitance, but hyper awareness. And a lot more questions to the journey going on at Nathan. And so that's kind of why I put it more towards the end when Nelly tries to explain what the Ndot was, because that's when I needed to kind of explain that there were 4 days for Ndot and that there are certain events going on, but I didn't want to provide exactly what was going on. And so it was obtuse at first, without the explanation that there are restrictions. And so that's why I put it there as opposed to at the beginning, because if you put it at the beginning, the non-Navajo reader is just gonna be constantly thinking, is what is the author not sharing with me? So like, once you bring it up that there's an issue, that's all they're gonna be hyper-focusing on.
Right, right. And I think when I first read this, and I actually liked how you were able to talk about things in a manner that was not going up cross any boundaries. Like you did everything very respectfully, but it wasn't like what's the word I'm looking for? It wasn't in your face. You know, like I really appreciate the way you wrote about things. And I think you chose really pivotal moments to kind of explain things in a way that felt natural and not like, oh, this needs to be, I need to put this here. You know, like it flowed very well to me where reading as a native and then reading as like things of non-native, because there is a question of, you know, how do you like write about indigeneity without, to a colonial gaze. And I think you did a good job because that's always in the back of my mind. To me, all of this encompasses an ethics of writing. My question to you then is like, what guided you in including appropriate content from sacred stories? Like how did you know where to set boundaries and not to go too far? Because these things we do talk about are sacred, but I think you did a great job of just like allowing people to kind of get a glimpse, but not see too much of it.
Of course, thank you for this really tough question. Well, in my initial drafts that I sent out to agents, I didn't shy away from sharing everything. And in my initial draft, like I was putting everything down because I knew that those versions weren't going to be published for the larger mainstream. And so it was a tactic of like getting that huge lump of clay with everything and all those stories and all the ceremonial events and activities, but then kind of taking it out and seeing what is necessary for the narrative. And again, that was one of the benefits of going through an MFA where I could present the information that is necessary for Nathan's journey, but also start taking away stuff that, you know, you shouldn't share. In addition to that, I was also actively seeking out confirmation from my own medicine man, Mahatashi, who is Chagdae by clan, my uncle by clan. And I was also asking my mom and people that I knew and reaching out to various individuals who weren't necessarily close to me, because I knew that my mom's gonna approve everything because she's my mom. And I knew my Hatafi is going to be like, yeah, that's fine. But, you know, and different Hatafi could say, no, Edo, you're not supposed to do that. So I just want to take a quick moment to, if there are people that have issues with what I've shared, please listen to them. Because, like, even just as Navajos, we are so diverse in our stories. We're so diverse in the Navajo language itself. There's so many dialects and so many different variations to those traditional stories and the restrictions imposed upon them. And so if you do encounter someone who says, hey, that's, you're not supposed to do that, ask them, why is that restriction? Because there's usually a reason behind it, and that reason is important. But coming back to your question, it was a combination of actively going and meeting in person and sitting inside a hogan with the Tefis and saying, is this okay to share, and talking about it and having the Hatafi say Edo da or Hukashin, that sounds okay. And the non-Navajo world, the MFA program, of figuring out like what is essential for a cohesive narrative.
It sounds like you engage more with the Hatafis than our own government does. But no, that's not supposed to be shot. But anyways, I was thinking about that. But yeah, no, I think your point about Navajos not being monolithic is perfect. When I'm reading some of these stories, I was wondering about all the different like variants. It's very leveled. And I think that's one thing that's great about this is it shows that there is a plurality within the Navajo Nation. And unlike organized religion, you know, where everything's kind of centralized and made to be one legible order, Navajos haven't necessarily gone through that. And I personally don't think there needs to be right now. And I like the fact that there are different stories. I'm glad that you were able to actually talk about the practices of speaking to these people who are knowledgeable about that. I don't think that's something a lot of people do. And I think it's a practice that's a very important thing, because literature is consumed not just by Navajos. And so like people's interpretation of Navajo people in general, I'm sorry, and indigenous people in general are going to be shaped by this.
Oh, thank you. That was my hugest source of anxiety throughout the entire process. It's like, how is this? Well, I felt, I don't want to say indifference, but I wasn't as worried about non-Navajo readers as I was about Navajo readers. and their response and reception of the book because of how close it talks about things that you're not supposed to talk about, specifically the diagnosis and the enemy way ceremony.
Right. Yeah, I would rather be criticized by a million non-natives, non-Navajos, than be criticized by like five Sunnies. Like it would be too much. Like if I had five grandmas criticizing me, I'd be like, nah, you're right. I'm so sorry. I need to do something else with my life. Or if it was a million people like that weren't Navajo, I'd be like, yeah, whatever. I don't care.
I don't think that anxiety ever goes away.
Right.
At least for me, it hasn't.
I still feel it. Yeah. When I'm talking to non-natives, I'm very careful with my words as to how I describe it. And if I feel that a word isn't the correct way, I really have to describe what I'm talking about so that they know that, like I said, development, you know, it's a whole baggage of things. And I have to really be like, when I say this word, I mean this, not this, you know, and I have to like create a whole network of meaning encounter. I'm sorry, but it has to be deployed so that I don't perpetuate tropes like that. Or I do things respectfully.
Yeah, definitely. Especially in this age where like one sentence out of your entire speech can be warped out of context. It's so very important to be thoughtful about what you say and how you say it. And yeah, that was something that my professors couldn't understand, the pressures of that, especially being like one of the first Native American, especially Navajos writing for Navajos. Yeah, especially being one of the first Navajos writing for young Navajo readers, that there is an added pressure of this is going to be talked about, this is going to be reflective, and this could potentially guide future books. And they didn't understand that. They're just like, you just need to focus on the story. You just need to focus on the story. I'm like, no, but there is an added level of how it interacts with the community that you guys as non-Navajos and non-natives don't have that pressure, you know?
Right, right. And it gets really complicated when you think of the litany of other Native people being represented in novels or like in work. And like you have this history of white people writing about Natives. And then you have even more recently kind of with this whole like issue of like non-Navajos writing about Navajos, you know, writing a story and incorporating things that, whoa, you shouldn't be saying this, or why are you depicting this? You know, did you ask anybody about this depiction? I won't say their name, because that's a whole nother podcast, but I'll just say like, oh, you yeah. know, like that,
I can know what you're talking about.
It caused a whole discourse of like indigeneity and pretend Indianism. But the idea was just like, what is your relation? And I think this person was like, oh yeah, I'm married into the Navajo people. That still doesn't gain you access to kind of write about these things. And I'm speaking about this pressure to really be careful about what we put out in the world. There's this theme of sickness that is throughout the book. And do you want to do spoilers? I don't want to spoil anything, because I do want people to read it. I read it, enjoyed it.
Are you talking about the halfway point or like,
I'll leave it. There's this theme of sickness that exists in the book. And I was curious as to what made you include this idea of like sickness? Because to me, it seems intentional the way it's attributed to one person who's going through something, as well as just the larger region within Church Rock.
Well, I don't think it's going too much into spoiler territory, but there are definitely two characters that are sick. And Nathan, the protagonist, his goal is to kind of heal both of them. One is the water monster, whose name is Pond. And the second is his uncle, named Uncle Jet, who is suffering from undiagnosed depression and PTSD and has resorted to substance abuse, alcoholism. He's an alcoholic. I didn't necessarily think of it as terms of sickness, but things that young Navajos were encountering in their real world, especially in our era of increased global warming and the effects of global warming. Like a lot of indigenous nations, not just indigenous nations, but people isolated from the larger cities, like we are encountering the effects of global warming at a much higher rate than our city counterparts. So it was always a reflection of the area and the people in that area. Not necessarily I want to set out with a theme of sickness and build upon it. It was more just like, what is the modern experience of a young Navajo growing up and, you know, living on the homelands? I'm struggling to not say reservation because a larger conversation is moving towards homelands, but that's why I'm kind of hesitating when I'm going to say the homelands as opposed to reservation, which is awkward for me right now. But yeah, I think upon further revisions, like the first time that I wrote it, it was mainly like the first drafts I wrote, it was mainly just what are young Navajo kids like me, what did I grow up experiencing? And then as I started getting into further drafts, further revisions, and, you know, recognizing the strengths of literature through my program, that's when I started to kind of hear from also my program colleagues that there was this theme of sickness. And once that was brought to my attention and I started to recognize it, I kind of like just started elevating it a little bit higher, because I think it was more just like a subconscious thing for me in the first drafts, but towards the latter revisions, it became a little more predominant and I could clarify that a lot easier.
Right. Yeah. No, I think, yeah, I don't, yeah. For me, when I read it, as I mentioned before recording, I read politics into everything. So when you have one individual suffering from PTSD and then you have this sick deity and the reason why they're sick, to me those two are related, which was this idea of U.S. imperialism and the function of extracting resources during the Cold War. And then you have this individual who came back from war in need of a certain ceremony. To me, those were really connected, and that's how I interpret it, that these two particular, they're in the same area. It made me think about like the sicknesses. And I'm thinking like the way I'm using the term sickness is like, what's the consequence of an unbalanced world? And that's what it did with me. That's how I was thinking. I was thinking about the politics that would be rooted in this book. When you were writing this, was there like a politics in this writing? To write about things on the Navajo Nation, you couldn't not include this. Mm-hmm. But these are important histories and politics that are involved.
There definitely is. But because of how many topics the book was already discussing, I didn't feel that it had the space to articulate my thoughts on imperialism and colonialism, because the focus again was healing, and that would have brought another layer that I just wasn't at that time ready to talk about. And again, my main focus was the idea that this was a continuation of the creation story. So that was always kind of like one of the main writing goals for Healer of the Water Monster, was the idea that the culture was reaching out to young Navajos for help, and that young Navajos could be heroes, that young Navajos could have important influence on the environment and the people around them. And it's not to say, but just even that small statement is political. It's very sad to say, but it's true. A lot of young Navajos don't feel that they have influence or power in their environment and the people around them. But I can say this, my second book, because I demonstrated the importance of the culture, is a lot more political. I'm being a lot more critical of the systems in place that are ravaging our resources, specifically water resources.
No, great. I love that. I think the use of literature that's in fiction is a great medium for like producing politics or getting people to start asking questions. And to me, this idea of the act of building upon or continuing the creation stories is politics. Imagine what kind of politics we could build if we did pull our values from those stories to also structure our government. It goes back to this idea that like, if, you know, settler colonialism isn't just like something that happened in the past, it's ongoing. And there are also other things, other forces that are actually indigenous forces that are also going on, like that we shape our environment just as much as this larger project shapes it through extraction. But yeah, no, I look forward to your next book. I was going to ask you, like, when's it coming out, but I don't want to pressure you to be like, it's going to come out this year or like next year.
We're aiming for next year, actually.
Oh, great. Great. I'm excited. I'm like, is it going to continue this story, or is it going to be kind of a different one? Oh, great. Great.
Nathan returns. Yeah. It's getting into spoiler territory, so I'm not going to share.
Yeah. We'll leave it.
Yeah. Nathan does continue his journey.
It's like 40 years in the future. And Nathan's a council delegate. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. I mean, one other thing too, like I kind of like sensed a little bit of the politics because of his mother. She was at a protest, and one particular thing you're like in the background water is life. And I was like, oh, okay, there it is. But that's like kind of like a common experience that most Navajos have. There's always that one relative that's out there anyways. So I'll end it with this. I just wanted to say my favorite characters are the spiders, all of the spiders. I fucking love the spiders, bro. I was like, I will never look at them the same way again. I liked Che, Chij, and then Che, Outhouse. I love them. I love that arc, dude, that character arc.
That actually was supposed to be horror. But I really, really suck at writing horror, apparently.
So I like the spiders. Yeah. I really like my favorite, the way you characterize the deities. I was like, this is great. I like the way that they had their personalities. I enjoyed it. My favorite one I had to say was Darkness. I don't know why I like Darkness. It could be because I'm an emo. Those ones were the ones that come out, and I suggest people read it so that they can pick out which their favorite characters are.
My favorite character was definitely Seed Collector.
Oh,
little grumpy horn toad.
I did. That was the other one. Yeah, I did like him. I liked him. I liked the way he would. I liked the way he was written, and I like his little like quips. And I was like, this is good. But yeah, thank you for joining me. I really